Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to the broadcast, and good to have you along here in this week of Thanksgiving. Of course, we don't need to wait till Thursday to be thankful, but thankful to have you listening in and being a regular part of what we're doing here on Faith Radio. I'm Neil Stavem, host of the program Connecting Faith. Ted Ross at the controls, and Ted, I guess most of our audience would be happy today, or not, right? Because they either they're Packers fans or they're Vikings fans. I guess we're not
maybe happy it's over if you're a Viking fan.
Sure, maybe yes, that was it.
They made it close at least, so that was good.
Yeah, well, we are into moral victories here, aren't we? That's been our hallmark for a number of years.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Sure, went to 4 Super Bowls, didn't win any of them. But all right, so. We're not going to talk Vikings.
No, we're thankful. We're thankful.
That's right. We do. Yes, we do have something much more important to talk about. In fact, in a few minutes, we're going to introduce our guest for today's topic, who did an amazing thing. I mean, we get used to seeing people around us that are, you know, on the maybe the lower edge, lower rung of society, and the homeless, and we get kind of used to just walking by without paying any attention. Our guest coming up today wanted to find out what that was like. And a few years back, he and a friend actually voluntarily lived on the street in 6 cities across the U.S. for 5 months, and has journaled about it and written a wonderful book that we're going to review. And it seems certainly appropriate as we head into this season when there's a lot of efforts among rescue missions to help fund their ministries. We're going to talk a little bit about the good work of rescue missions, but get a perspective, a street-level perspective, if you will, as we talk under the overpass with Mike Yankowski. We're going to get to that in a little bit. But first, I just want to say we are excited about having just launched the Angel Tree campaign here on Faith Radio. If you recall, last year was our first opportunity to partner with Prison Fellowship in this wonderful ministry called Angel Tree. Angel Tree was founded by Mary Kay Beard, an ex-prisoner, who served 6 years in prison and watched incarcerated mothers scramble at Christmas time to find a way to get a gift of any kind to their children. And so back in the early 80s, Prison Fellowship got involved, and it started out in Alabama, and now it's grown. Last year, over 374,000 children were able to receive a gift and a message from their mom or dad in prison. And, you know, the reality is that 1 in 28 American school-aged children have an incarcerated parent. Can you imagine that? Wow. I mean, it's just, that's it, one in every classroom, or it's more in some places. And 2.7 million children whose fathers or mothers are incarcerated. And many times, in fact, almost all the time, if they're federal offenses, those parents are hundreds of miles away from their kids. So the likelihood of them seeing their children, well, so we have an opportunity here during this month. And well, right through Christmas Day, actually, that we're going to ask you, our Faith Radio listeners, to partner with us and give so that a child could receive a Christmas gift, the gospel, and a message of love from their incarcerated parents. And just saying $84 is going to help reach 6 children. You can do, obviously, more than that. You can do less than that. I just encourage you to do something. And to help sort of launch that, we just want to share a story. We've got some wonderful testimonies from people whose lives have been changed as a result of Angel Tree. You're going to love this story from Jeffrey Hooper.
Jeffrey Hopper pled guilty to stealing $1.1 million from the Stardust Casino in Las Vegas. Because that's who he was, and that's what he did.
I've lived most of my life as a criminal who sold narcotics, who dealt in cocaine and acid, who robbed people, who robbed casinos.
Serving time in a Texas prison cell, his prime motivation was revenge.
I had a list, every single name of someone who had ever wronged me. What they did and what I was going to do to them when I got out was over 100 people.
His only weak spot was his 5-year-old daughter. When word came out that the chaplain could arrange for a Christmas gift to be sent to Amanda, he signed up, not expecting too much.
I didn't think anything of it until later I received a letter from my precious baby girl. A little pencil-scribed piece of notebook paper about the gift she had received and that she loved me.
For the first time, Jeffrey Hopper experiences love without condition.
I was floored. I didn't understand why these people were doing such things for other people. And why? Why do things for people who can't do anything in return?
Jeffrey's questions would be answered by his very own daughter on Christmas Day during a specially arranged visit. First, of course, Amanda thanked him for the present he had sent and promised to save it for just the right moment.
She told me all about the Candyland game, a game that she was going to wait until I got out before she would open.
Then, 5-year-old Amanda shared a new idea with her father, one he had never before understood. The volunteers with Angel Tree had told her about the wonder of God's love, grace, and forgiveness.
She went on and on in that visit about how Angel Tree had made it possible for her to know and understand that she could love me and forgive me just as Christ loved all of us.
But what about all those names on Jeffrey's revenge list? Could love overcome such anger?
And finally, the realization for me was that God didn't keep such a list. And after that visit, went back to the chapel and fell apart. And it was on that day that I gave my life to Christ.
On his last day as an inmate, Jeffrey held tightly to his Bible. Amanda had something in her hands as well.
I walked out those prison doors, and standing at the car was a little girl holding a Candyland game. Unopened. She had waited those 2 years to open that gift to play the first time with me.
A child's board game, a thank you note, pencil on paper, a visit from a little girl who shares a simple truth, a hardened inmate is broken. And that can be a very good thing. Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 that grace is all you need. Jesus' power works best in weakness. If God has revealed His forgiveness, love, and provision to you, this is your chance to give back.
You have a wonderful opportunity to make a difference in the life of a child. You know, here at Faith Radio, we've set a goal. We believe that with the partnership of friends from all across the upper Midwest here listening at Faith Radio, that we could see 1,000 children being impacted here this Christmas. Thanks to your involvement, $84 will reach 6 children with a Christmas gift, the gospel, and a message of love from their incarcerated parents. I want to just encourage you, if you would generously be involved with us. And you can go to our website, myfaithradio.com. There's a link right on the very front page there, and I encourage you to sign up there, or you can call a toll-free number, 855-59-ANGEL. It's 855-592-6435, 855-59-ANGEL. Would you be generous and be a part of this wonderful outreach, Angel Tree, giving a gift, the gospel, and a message of love? It's a great way to do it. Excited about what God will do in impacting and changing these kids' lives and these families as well. We'll talk more about it as we go along. We just wanted to give you that opportunity today and say don't let the day go by without praying about at least what your part could be. Let's get into today's topic. I'm excited to welcome back to the microphone Mike Yankowski. Mike is a writer and a speaker, spends much of his time compelling audiences around the world toward a Christ-centered response to our world's greatest needs. And when he's not writing or on the road speaking, he's usually found doing something outdoors, usually hiking or running. Now he's right now pursuing a PhD studies at Notre Dame. So we're talking to him. He's relocated from the beautiful Vancouver, BC and Seattle area, moved to the heartlands. Mike, are you adjusting to having the wind blowing all the time?
Yeah, I think so. The winters are a bit different, though, I'll say that much.
You have a chance to use more of the layers, right?
Yeah, the layering approach, that's the key, and the down. I think that's a really important part to sort of staying warm here in the heartland as well. I tell you what, last winter was unlike anything my wife or I had ever seen before. I mean, she's from Oregon, and I'm from Colorado, so we were familiar with snow, but the polar vortex really threw us for a loop last year, to say the least.
Down and lots of fatty foods. That's just what we're doing. I want to just say.
Yeah.
Just say. Well, it does kind of bring up a good point because, you know, all around the country, there are men and women, young and old, who are, you know, they're basically just have the clothes on their back to kind of keep them warm. And you voluntarily pursued life as a homeless person, but I'm just thinking that you didn't go into the fall winter season, did you?
Now, you know, we actually moved south as fall and winter came on. So we were May through November, my friend Sam and I, as we were on the streets of six different American cities. And we were in Denver and Washington, D.C., and then Portland, San Francisco, Phoenix, and San Diego. But we moved south along the West Coast as fall and winter began to set in. So we were actually in San Diego in November. So a little bit of a different climate, to say the least.
But I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about just some of the challenges of life on the street. I guess maybe, you know, before we take a break, let me ask you, because this has been several years since you did your, I guess you kind of quote, undercover work. I'm wondering how it impacts you today, or I mean, what ways has it changed you having that experience?
Yeah, you know, that's a brilliant question. And yes, it has significantly impacted me and the work that I'm doing now. You mentioned a few moments ago that I am having the opportunity to pursue a PhD, but I'm doing a PhD in ethics, in theological ethics, because I'm driven by that question, how should we live? How should we live in light of who Christ is and what he has done for us and what he has called us and invited us into? So very much this experience that my friend Sam and I had of living on the streets and watching how people consistently ignored us or pretended like we didn't exist or treated us like we were garbage because of what we looked like or what we smelled like or who people thought we were. Very few people took the chance to actually get to know us and ask us who we were or what we were up to. So this experience, almost a decade ago now, this is driving me towards asking this question, what does it mean to be a follower of Christ? What does it mean to live because Christ loves us? And how do we love our neighbors as ourselves, not in abstract ways, but in real, tangible, practical kinds of ways? So very much so, this experience is still orienting my life and driving me towards seeking to be a faithful follower of Christ. So very much so.
Did you encounter homelessness maybe before you started and said, you know, I need to learn more about this? Or was it, you know, was it a sort of a bad experience or something that prompted you to say, you know, I want to actually research this from the ground level?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. Again, you know, I was a freshman at a Christian college called Westmont in Santa Barbara, California. And, you know, I had written a paper on the parable of the Good Samaritan, and I'd done well on the paper. You know, I'd gotten an A on the paper, and I'd analyzed Jesus's parable and read lots of research papers about it and scholarly articles and books about it. And I wrote a good paper, and I understood it in the abstract. Then about a week after I got my paper back, I was sitting in a church service at the church I was attending at the time in Santa Barbara, and the pastor stood up and said, hey, we're going to talk about the parable of the Good Samaritan. That's going to be a sort of orienting parable for us this year as we talk about loving our neighbors as ourselves. And, you know, I sort of, like a college freshman who just aced his paper on the parable of the Good Samaritan, I, you know, thought I didn't really need to pay attention to the sermon. I sort of kicked back in my pews, right, because I'm thinking to myself, dude, I already got this. I got this one down. I already aced this one. I mean, I'm kind of thinking about raising my hands and telling them, you know, if you miss any of the fine points, I'll email you my paper and sort of fill you in on the details, right? That's my attitude. But then he says this. He says, I want you to think about this as a story that invites you to enter in. I want you to think about this as a typology of characters. Which character most characterizes you? And as he read the parable of the Good Samaritan, what was running through my mind is what had happened the night before. I had been downtown Santa Barbara with a couple of my friends, and we'd gone to dinner and to a movie. And as we're walking from the movie theater back to the parking lot to get back into our cars and drive back up the hill to our Christian college campus, we passed two homeless guys. And they were sitting on the left, on my left, on the sidewalk. And as my friends and I approached, we turned to one another and we laughed. We cracked a joke. We literally just engaged with one another so that we did not have to engage the two homeless men who were sitting on the side of the road. And we walked right by on the other side of the road, never having looked at them, never even acknowledging them. For all intents and purposes, they weren't even there. And then in that next morning, a Sunday morning, sitting in the church service, the realization of my own hypocrisy is what sort of sparked this idea. The fact that I could be a college student acing my New Testament papers about the parable of the Good Samaritan and simultaneously pretending like people who are created in God's image don't exist, pretending like they do not exist and walking right by them, the gap between what I was proclaiming with my mouth, what I was writing papers about, and how I was actually living, that gap is what I believe God used to spark this idea to go and to actually enter into homelessness, to understand what's it like from the inside to be a human being created in God's image, having to endure that on a consistent daily basis. What's it like to be told by people's actions that you do not matter, that you do not exist, that you are not worth their time, that you're not even worth their acknowledging your existence? What's it like? And on the flip side of that question, what can we as followers of Christ do? How do we put our faith into action? How do we stop just talking about this faith? How do we stop just believing this faith and actually start living it? That's what drove Sam and I into this five-month experience on the streets of six different American cities.
We'll find out more about what it is like and what we can do in the moments ahead, and encourage you to stay tuned as we talk more with Mike Yankowski. Mike has written a powerful experience of his journey. A journey of faith in the streets of America. It's called Under the Overpass. Got a couple of copies to give away. You'll find it challenging and revealing. And I hope that you'll join the conversation with us as well today as you call 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. And we'll talk more in just a moment. Stay tuned. Today about life as a homeless person and getting a firsthand perspective. Mike Yankowski is a writer and a speaker and is pursuing PhD study in a better way that we can actually live out our Christian faith, that we can love the Lord with all our heart, soul, mind, strength, and love our neighbor as itself. What does that look like? He experienced it by living on the streets for 5 months in six different cities. He and a companion traveled, and he's told his story in the wonderful book called Under the Overpass. And we've asked Mike here today just to kind of help review that story a little bit. And Mike, you did live, as you mentioned, six different U.S. cities. I'm wondering, are there uniquenesses to each of the cities' homeless population, maybe, or treatments of the homeless? Give us some sort of big picture view.
Yeah. Great question. There certainly are both similarities and differences. I think, you know, in terms of just generalizations, and obviously I think that's one of the things I want to say is Sam and I were consistently surprised by how often our assumptions and our presuppositions were shattered by the actual people we encountered on the streets. You know, I went in with stereotypes in my head. I went in with presuppositions and ideas of who I was going to encounter and why they were on the streets. But I tell you what, we met all swaths of humanity on the streets. We met people who hadn't finished high school. We met people who had PhDs. We met people who spoke one language. We met people who spoke six. We met people who had been in that city their entire life, and we met people who hadn't been born in this country. We met people from all across. And so I think that's one of the things I want to say, and one of the things I want to encourage your listeners to sort of grapple with, is that every single person has a unique story, an individual story, who they are, what they've gone through, where they've come from, what they've experienced, how God is particularly speaking to them, what their hopes are, what their dreams are, what their failures in the past may have been, and what their experiences may have been in the past, positive and negative. So that's one of the things I want to say, is that just there's an enormous variety of experiences and stories on the streets. But that said, you're right. There was a particular sort of flavor, if that's the right word, a particular feeling of each of the cities that Sam and I found ourselves in. For example, homelessness in Washington, D.C. looked very different than homelessness in Portland, Oregon, when we were there. For example, in Washington, D.C., the average age of a homeless person was above the age of 40. When Sam and I were on the streets in Portland, the average age of a homeless person was about 22. So very, very different demographics. And that meant that people related very differently. In Washington, D.C., people were usually isolated, maybe with one other person, whereas in Portland, Portland when we were there again, most people were together in larger groups. So it meant that each of the cities that we found ourselves in had a very particular feeling to it and a very particular way in which the community either embraced or shunned the homeless community. So, for example, in San Francisco, there are so many people who are on the streets, so many homeless people, that a lot of the San Francisco citizens, at least in our experience, again, when we were there, were very jaded and very tired of people being in this, on the streets of the city. Whereas in Portland, people were much more accepting, much more helpful of Sam and I when we were on the streets. And again, this is just our particular experience, but this is certainly what we found as we were in each of those cities, that there was a very different feeling. Some similarities, some generalities, of course, but a very distinct feeling in each of the cities. And then in Phoenix, for example, Phoenix is such a spread out city that we very rarely saw other homeless people when we were in Phoenix, and very rarely did we see large groups of homeless people because it's just so spread out. The city is so spread out. So we would busk, you know, play music, trying to make money in one part of the city, and then we would go to another part of the city where there was an all-you-could-eat buffet that we would be able to afford. And then there was another place that we would go across the city in order to find a place to sleep in one of the shelters that the city made available. So very different as opposed to, say, San Francisco, where we would busk and be very close to the place we might be able to find shelter for the evening and very close to a place where we might be able to get food for a discounted rate, et cetera. In Portland, several of the restaurants left food outside of their restaurants so that people who were on the streets could find it in the planters or leave it on top of the dumpsters instead of inside of the dumpsters, so you didn't have to dumpster dive in order to find your dinner. You could just find it on the top of the dumpster. So people were going out of their way in Portland, for example, to help care for the homeless community. So each city was very, very different in our experience.
Is it, is it better to have, like, you know, San Francisco, Tenderloin District, where you've got thousands of people sort of crammed together, I guess, in destitute situations, or is it better to have them spread out? I mean, it seems like there's sort of a congregating sense, isn't it, of the homeless or maybe hanging around missions, perhaps? Or?
Yeah, I think that's true. And again, each city is very unique in each particular situation. Each organization who's attempting to help the homeless and aid the homeless is going to be a unique situation, obviously. But, you know, I think there are some arguments to be made for helping sort of consolidate services so that, for example, if an individual is needing a place to stay for the evening and needing some medical attention, they don't have to spend, you know, half the day traveling across the city, or if they need perhaps identification, they don't have to travel, you know, to another part of the city and spend a lot of time and scarce resources doing that as well. So I think there are some arguments to be made for consolidation. I also think that there are some arguments to be made for consolidation in terms of consistency. So people realize, okay, I know I'm going to be going to this organization for this assistance, and they're going to help me and get connected to this other organization. So there's a little bit of consistency in that. And I think that that makes a lot of sense. Now, other people may have, you know, disagreements with me about that for a variety of reasons. But I think there's an argument to be made for some sort of consolidation. But, you know, there are also strong arguments to be made against that. One of which I would say is, you know, I think that there's something about the NIMBY approach, you know, not in my backyard approach, that has pushed many organizations in many cities to the outskirts because the city more or less has a desire to contain, quote unquote, the homeless issue, quote unquote. And I think that that's problematic because I think that there's a lot to be said about realizing that, you know what, these are men and women, these are human beings created in God's image, just like the rest of us who are not on the street. And I think there's something to be said about knowing and recognizing that they're part of our community, and that this is an aspect of what it means to be a community, that a community has the full range of socioeconomic status, from the highest in terms of wealth to people who are trying to survive one day to the next. What does it mean for us to love our neighbors as ourselves in all of those strata?
Let me just jump in. We've got a hard break coming up, and we'll return and talk more with Mike Yankowski in just a moment as we talk Under the Overpass.
Give me your eyes for just one second. Give me your eyes so I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity. Give me your arms with the
brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me a heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see. Yeah.
We are pretty good at overlooking, aren't we? We're getting used to looking the other way, those that are around us that appear, well, a little shabby on the edges. We're talking today about homelessness and getting a firsthand perspective from Mike Yankowski. Mike and a friend spent 5 months living in 6 U.S. cities on the streets, literally on the streets, and he wrote about it in the great book called Under the Overpass, A Journey of Faith on the Streets of America. We've got a couple of copies to give away, and you're welcome to sign up for that and maybe get some great insight, too, about how we can more effectively minister and reach out and to care in the name of Jesus. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number, 877-933-2484. Mike is currently pursuing PhD studies at Notre Dame, living in the Midwest after spending time in the Northwest, and has done a lot of speaking and writing on this topic. And Mike, you were talking a little bit about, you know, some of the ways that the different cities and organizations approach this. You mentioned about, you know, even maybe leaving food outside a restaurant on top of the dumpsters that are in the dumpster. I'm curious. So, I mean, you recount lots of situations where you're in eating establishments, and you know, there's a point where the staff says, "Hey, it's time for you to go," or something. So, are businesses unreasonable when they chase you off their property? And are there other options that would better serve the homeless population?
Yeah, a very good question, and I think a difficult question to answer, and I think the one that we need to be really careful to try and understand the perspective on everyone's side as much as that's possible. Obviously, business owners are trying to figure out, gosh, you know, in a tough economy or in a tough situation, how do we stay in business, and how do we, you know, protect the experience of using our establishment, using our business for all of our patrons, for everybody who is going to be, you know, a customer and not just a particular individual, for example. So I think that's an important consideration to keep in mind, and I think it's fair to sort of ask homeless members of the community to be mindful of other members of the community, just as it's fair, I think, to ask business owners to be mindful of the homeless members of the community and to try and work together towards good solutions. So, for example, I think one of the most important things that business owners can do is to become aware of the various options that exist for homeless members of your community. Find out about the rescue missions. Go to agrm.org and find out about the resources that are available through the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions. That's the network of Christ-centered rescue missions that exists all across the country. So find out about the organizations that exist in your area and the services that they offer. Call them up and say, hey, I want to know what you all have available for people. If someone's in need and they say, hey, I need a bus ticket, well, does the rescue mission offer bus tickets? Is there a way that we can figure that out, help connect the dots? One thing that I'll just sort of say, in my experience and my own practice, I will rarely give someone straight cash unless I know that person and I have a fair bit of confidence in what it's going to be used for. I do that. I say that. My own belief and my perspective on that is that just giving someone cash may or may not be used for good purposes. You know, it could be used exactly for what they say, maybe to go get a cup of coffee or maybe to go get a bus ticket. But it could also be used for purposes which are destructive. And so my interpretation of loving my neighbor as myself does not include helping them destroy themselves, whereas it does include helping them access something if they're in need of it. So food, shelter, a bus ticket, et cetera. I'm happy to help someone out if that need is actually what they're going for. So I've walked with people to the bus station to get a bus ticket. I've gone with them to a local coffee shop to buy them a cup of coffee. I've gone with them to a motel if they said they needed a place to stay for the evening and paid for them to stay in a motel, those kinds of things. I've walked with them to a local shelter and helped them get in for the night so they have a place to stay. Those kinds of things, actually being willing to connect with what a person is saying they actually need, I think that's an important consideration for all of us, more than just business owners, but for all of us as a part of the communities in which we live. Also, especially for businesses, I think that it's a very important missing link that exists. I think it's very necessary for local businesses to connect with the shelters, to connect with the rehabilitation programs, to connect with the rescue missions in your area and say, hey, you know, I have a construction crew, or I have, you know, a cleaning crew. I have some crew that when you have graduates of your program who have gone through your rehabilitation program or who have earned their GEDs or whatever, if they're looking for work, put them in contact with me. If you trust that person, I want to trust that person as well, and help them stand on their own 2 feet, help them become a productive member of society or a more productive member of society, et cetera. I think that's a very important and often missing link, in my experience, within the Rescue Mission Network, is oftentimes rescue missions do a fantastic job of helping people move through a period of sobriety and rehabilitation and get the necessary trainings that they might need for employment. But then it's very difficult for them to actually connect with stable employment after that fact. And it's an absolutely necessary piece for us in our community as we're seeking to love our neighbors as ourselves, is to connect people who are coming through those rehabilitation programs with good, stable jobs and with good companies. So that's an important consideration, and that's something I would certainly recommend.
Did the most of the people you encountered want a better life, or you know, were they just lacking the opportunity to get off the street?
Yeah, again, a fascinating question, and I think a very good question, and also one that I want to just encourage. The reality of everybody's story is different. What I mean by that is we met people who, you know, if they had been able to find stable employment and they had been able to find a place to stay, I think they would no longer have been on the streets. Whereas we also did encounter people who had been on the streets for a lengthy period of time and had come to say, and I believe come to believe, that they didn't mind being on the streets anymore. Certainly some people choose to be on the streets. It's an intentional choice. But I think it's a very important question for us to unpack what goes into that choice and what goes on behind that choice to be on the streets. There's a substantial amount of mental illness that exists within the homeless population, a substantial amount of drug and alcohol addiction that exists. Not everybody is suffering from a mental instability or is drug or alcohol addicted. By no means is that the case for everyone on the streets. But a substantial portion of people on the streets are suffering from either some sort of drug or alcohol addiction or mental instability. So if someone who is mentally unstable is saying, I choose to be on the streets, someone who is either, say, schizophrenic, for example, and saying, I choose to be on the streets, that I think would mean something different if they are consistently taking medication versus not consistently taking medication, for example. So I want to just encourage people to try and evaluate that question. Do people want to be on the streets on a case-by-case basis? Understanding that there's so much that goes into all of our decisions and so much that is in all of our histories that may have led someone to be in that position or want to be in that position in a way that we might understand it differently. So I think, you know, one thing that you've heard me saying this consistently, is we need to deal with people as individuals. And I think that's something I want to emphasize. When Sam and I were on the streets, what changed the day for us is when someone took the time to acknowledge that we were a human being. Because we would sit on the concrete and thousands of people would pass us by, pretending like we didn't even exist. I mean, it was so humiliating and shocking and frustrating and disillusioning to be on the receiving end of what I had done so many times before, to suddenly feel what it's like to be intentionally ignored. And in that situation, if somebody was willing to look us in the eyes, if someone was willing to treat us like we were human beings, that radically changed the day. And I was in Portland, Oregon not too long ago, and I had some extra money and some extra time, and so I bought some burritos. I mean, these are simple $2.50 bean and cheese burritos. And I walked around downtown Portland for a couple of hours and, you know, offered these burritos to people who were on the streets. And, you know, sometimes people cussed me out, told me off, said they hated me, they hated burritos, they weren't hungry, they didn't want to talk to me, they didn't want to have a burrito. And so I said, okay, that's fine, I hope you have a good day. And I went to the next person. And one of these guys I sat down next to, you know, I offered him a burrito and he said, yeah, thanks, that'd be great. I haven't eaten in a while, it'd be fantastic. And so we just started talking, you know, while he was eating the burrito. And we're talking about whatever, you know, baseball, basketball, football, politics, weather. You know, if you could go anywhere, where would you go in the States? Or where's your favorite place? Where have you traveled? You know, those kinds of questions, just general conversational type questions. Halfway through his burrito, he turned to me and he said, Mike, do you know you've changed my week? And I thought, you know, what are you talking about, man? It's a $2.50 bean and cheese burrito. And what do you mean it's changed your week? And He said, no, I'm serious. It's not the burrito. I mean, the burrito's fine, but you're the first person who's talked to me in a week. Thank you. And I mean, I was blown away at that point, right? Because it's like, here's 5 minutes of my day and $2.50 worth of bean and cheese burrito. And it's an opportunity to rehumanize somebody. I think it's one of the most fascinating lenses through which to read the gospel stories. We consistently see Jesus rehumanizing the people who are on the margins of his society, the people who were the outcasts, the people who the quote-unquote respectable people in Jesus's day will not associate with. They'll have nothing to do with them, the people who are on the margins, the leper, the people who are paralyzed, the prostitutes, the sinners, the quote-unquote tax collectors. These are the people who Jesus, again and again in the gospel, consistently makes an effort to go and to be with. And as he's with them, he rehumanizes them. He relates with them. He treats them like they're human beings. He treats them like they are human beings created in the image of God. And I think that that's one of the most important things that we need to keep in mind, particularly as people who are Christians, who are claiming to be followers of Christ, a willingness to rehumanize one another by the way we treat one another, not treating one another merely as problems to be solved, but treating one another as people created in the image of the creating, sustaining, and redeeming God. And I think that that means looking one another in the eyes, treating one another like we're human beings, not treating one another like we're just a waste of time or wastes of space or wastes of life. I think that that's a very important aspect of how we respond to one another and how we treat the men and women of our community who are in desperate economic situations.
You know, Mike, we often assume that it's food and shelter that are primary concerns for the homeless, but you also address the need for the body basics, you know, just you know, bathing and bathroom facilities. I mean, give us a sense of what daily life on the street was like. And was there a point where you just, you know, you knew this was an experiment, but there was a point where you just said, you know, my emotional reserves are gone.
Very much so. The emotional reserves dried up very quickly for both Sam and I. I mean, you know, just it's very difficult to get a consistent amount of sleep, not just consistent, but any sort of sustained duration of sleep. So, I mean, Sam and I would go to sleep at 10 o'clock at night, but we'd be woken up at midnight because of a couple of rats running through our bags searching for food. We'd be woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning when, you know, a police truck or a fire truck went by or a police officer went by with the sirens blaring. We became very, very attuned actually to the sound of someone's footsteps close by to us. You know, I think just sort of being nervous, not knowing what was going to happen or if somebody was going to jump us in the middle of the night. So anytime anybody walked by, even, you know, 25, 50 feet away, we would both instantly wake up. So we never slept for very long at a particular given time. You know, if it started raining, you had to run and find some place to try and stay dry. So we were constantly being woken up and thus constantly exhausted. I mentioned we were in Phoenix, and there were several hundred plus degree days when we were in Phoenix. And when we were in Washington, D.C., and the humidity was so extremely high, I mean, we were constantly dehydrated, walking around with a headache, exhausted, dehydrated, et cetera. So very quickly, the emotional reserves were just gone. They were gone very, very quickly. And yes, I think you mentioned, Neil, you know, the need for food and for shelter. And yes, those are important aspects, especially as we're coming into the winter months. Those are very important aspects, especially as, you know, the temperature is going to be dropping very rapidly as snowstorms moving through. Maybe we'll have another polar vortex this year. And I think that that's an extraordinary invitation for church communities and for nonprofits to be willing to love and to serve our local community, to open our doors for weather amnesty and those kinds of programs that exist, I know, I'm sure exist in your area as well. And maybe some of your listeners can connect with their church or connect with the networks of people who are providing those kinds of assistance in their local areas and join in. But I also want to suggest that beyond food and shelter, there's an invitation to sort of look at the bigger picture of what's going on. So take, for example, you know, the retort that Sam and I heard regularly when we were on the streets and that I'm sure many people who are on the streets now are still hearing, the retort, just get a job. You know, just get a job. If you just get a job, you'd get off the streets and it'd be a lot better for everybody. Well, if someone is on the streets, it is very difficult to get a job because take, for example, okay, I woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning. I slept on the concrete last night. My clothes are rather dirty. Maybe I had to make a decision of whether or not to eat last night or to do laundry, and I chose to eat instead of doing laundry because that's all the money that I had from busking. And now I'm going to try and go get a job. So I'm going to go in, I'm going to try and fill out a job application, but what is my address? What is my telephone number? What does my identification say? Do I even have identification? What is my job history like? You know, so these kinds of questions are very, very important when we say that someone needs to find employment. Many organizations exist, and I mentioned the AGRM before, the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions. Many organizations like the AGRM Rescue Missions provide employment support. So that will include everything from training to making sure you know how to fill out a resume to making sure you know how you have a consistent address that you can put on your job applications, as well as a telephone number where potential employers can contact you. All of those are essential aspects to helping people actually gain employment. Because if someone just walks in off of the streets having not showered in who knows how long, it's unlikely that they're going to be perceived of as someone who is going to be a consistent employee or is going to be a strong employee by a potential employer. So there are some assistances that is necessary to help someone and to come alongside of someone as they are seeking employment. That's a very important aspect that I would say is absolutely necessary. And then I also just mentioned a willingness to treat men and women like they're actually human beings. And that is sort of getting at the psychological implications of being on the streets. Let me just try and get at this this way. When Sam and I came back from being on the streets, it took both of us an extremely long period of time to sort of integrate back into non-homeless life. And I think, as I reflected upon it, that part of that is because Sam and I started to subconsciously believe we deserved to be treated like garbage. And what I mean by that is we were just sort of slowly conditioned, I think, to being ignored, to being turned away, to being told by people's actions that we did not matter or that we were a blight on society, et cetera, et cetera. And that took a very long time to wear off or for us to unlearn. And so all the more so, I think it's essential to understand that for a man or a woman who has perhaps been on the streets for who knows how long, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, what is it like for them? What have they been through? What is their sense of self-worth like? What have they been told consistently by people's actions about their self-worth? These are very, very deep questions that, again, as we go back to from the Christian perspective, the idea of Jesus rehumanizing us and restoring us to who we were created to be, that we need to be mindful of, that it takes a long time. It's not just, you know, snapping your fingers and suddenly you're off the streets and a healthy, flourishing member of society. That is a very lengthy process, which we have to be willing, as more stable members of society perhaps, or people who are more rooted in a community, to be willing to come alongside of others to encourage them, to surround them, and to help them along the way, give them a hand up, in a sense, to help reestablish their lives and to become the people that they want to become. I think that's a very, very important aspect of all of this as we consider it, especially from the perspective of followers of Christ.
Getting great insight today from Mike Yankowski. Mike has written about his experience living as a homeless person, six cities over 5 months across the United States. He wrote about it in a wonderful book called Under the Overpass, A Journey of Faith on the Streets of America. We'll get more perspective from Mike in just a moment. In fact, we'll talk a little bit about maybe what he appreciates most about the work of rescue missions and ministries to the downtrodden, and offer us some more maybe solutions, some strategies, and some challenge that we can be involved in. You can join the conversation if you like. Sign up for a copy of the book, 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484. Do something. We want to do the right thing. I want to get some perspective from Mike Yankowski, maybe what steps that would be. He sort of touched on them, but we'll review once again as we talk about his experience under the overpass. It's his journal of life on the streets, a journey of faith in the streets of America. Mike and a friend spent 5 months living in six cities as homeless, and you know, they were with only a backpack, a sleeping bag, and a guitar, and they experienced all the extremes, hunger, uncertainty, danger, exhaustion, depression, social rejection, all of it by their own choice. And out of that has come some good insight from Mike's been sharing with us today. Mike, I'm curious to know, was there something that was maybe the most surprising or encouraging thing that a stranger did for you when you were living on the street?
That's a great question. There were many very encouraging experiences that Sam and I had when we were on the streets. But I'll tell one story, and this is actually from Washington, D.C. So Sam and I had spent the day busking, you know, playing music on the city streets, trying to make enough money to eat that evening. And, you know, we would regularly go to rescue missions or homeless shelters in order to eat, in order to find shelter. But when we weren't staying in a shelter, we would be busking, you know, panhandling outside, asking for people's donations in order to be able to eat during the day. And so this particular day, we had busked all day and had not made any money. And an elderly homeless man and homeless woman said to us, "Hey, you know what? It's Friday night. Why don't you guys go out to Georgetown, just walk out to the city of Georgetown, and there's a restaurant there. You could play your guitars in front of this restaurant, and you'll probably do very well. You know, it's a Friday night. Lots of people will be going out for a night on the town. Lots of money, lots of wealth out in Georgetown. Just go out there." So Sam and I walked from downtown D.C. out to Georgetown, and we found this restaurant, beautiful restaurant, four-star restaurant, right in front of the banks. Right along the banks of the Potomac River, and it was just beautiful. You know, several nightclubs in the area. We knew we had sort of hit a spot that would have a lot of people over the next couple of hours. And we sat down and we started playing, and we played our guitars from 6 p.m. until 10 p.m., hoping that people would give us enough money so that we could go somewhere and buy dinner that evening after not having eaten that day. We played for 4 hours from 6 p.m. until 10 p.m., and we had made $1.18. And nobody had, you know, given us any doggy bags of takeout from the restaurant or anything. So Sam and I looked at each other about 10 p.m. and said, "Gosh, you know, we're not going to eat, not in Georgetown, not on $1.18." And we said, "You know, why don't we just close our guitar, you know, and go find a place to sleep, and maybe we'll find a free breakfast tomorrow." We're just finishing our last song when all of a sudden this group of little boys comes walking along the boardwalk. And they see Sam and I sitting there on the ground, you know, with our guitar cases open, playing and singing, and these boys run up and surround us. And as we finish that last song, the leader of the group of boys steps forward. And they're all under the age of 10. I mean, they're young kids. And the leader of this group of boys steps forward, and he looks me straight in the eyes, and he says, "Hey, do you want to donate to us? We are from the Boys and Girls Club of America, and we're raising money for our summer baseball uniforms." And I looked from him to my guitar case and back, and I said, "Sure, buddy. You know, we have $1.18. If you want it, go ahead, take it. It's yours. Go for it for your baseball uniforms." At that moment, from the back of this group of little boys, the youngest, smallest kid steps forward. He steps up, and he's maybe 7 or 8 years old. He pushes all of his friends out of the way, and he comes up, and he stands right in front of me. And he looks me straight in the eyes, and he says, "Hey, you guys don't have any money at all, do you? You don't have anything." And I said, "Well, bud, you know, I mean, not right now, no. I mean, other than this, we have $1.18, but other than that, not right now, no." And he thought about it for a minute, put his hand into his pocket, pulled out $1.25 of his baseball uniform money, put it into the guitar case, looked back at me and said, "Don't worry about it, bro. I got you covered." And what blew Sam and I away that night is not the fact that that one kid gave us 7 more cents than all of the thousands of adults who had walked by over the previous 4 hours. I mean, I think that's interesting, right? Like, here's this little kid being more generous than all these adults. I think that's interesting. But what was so transformative that evening is that group of little boys were the only ones who saw us that whole night. They were the only people who acknowledged our existence. They were the only people who stopped. They were the only people who treated us like we were human beings instead of garbage, instead of something to just be looked away from. And that changed the experience of that whole evening, of that whole week, I would say. And that's the reason I'm still sharing this story now, is because that moment of their willingness to acknowledge our existence was profoundly transformative and profoundly encouraging. And I'll also mention, Neil, that, you know, Sam and I regularly went to churches. We regularly slept right in front of churches just because we wanted to see how are Christians going to respond. I mean, that's one of the big questions that I went into this with, and Sam as well. How are Christians going to respond? Because I knew how I had responded, or rather not responded, despite being a Christian, despite going to a Christian college, despite acing my papers on the parable of the Good Samaritan. I knew how I had failed to respond. We wanted to find out how are other Christians responding. And I can tell you some encouraging stories and some very discouraging stories as well, where literally people refused to engage with us on the front steps of the church, and everybody went through the side doors of the church in order to enter in on a Sunday morning for the church service. But they turned the speakers on outside so we could hear the good news, quote unquote. And the person giving the announcements apologized to the congregation for the two bums on the front doorstep and promised that we would not be there next week. So pretty discouraging experiences too, but also some wonderful experiences of men and women who were putting their faith into action and seeking to engage us and seeking to care for us as we would hope we would all be willing to care for someone who's in a position of need in our community.
Our time has gotten away from us, and there's much more of the story we would like to share. We don't have time for right now. I want to just encourage you to look into the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions, agrm.org. It's a place to start putting your faith into action and just find out the good work that they're doing. And you can also find out more about Mike's great work, Under the Overpass, A Journey of Faith in the Streets of America. Mike Yankowski joining us today here on Connecting Faith. You can check the podcast out on our website, myfaithradio.com.